I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. It's estimated that 70,000 Americans were forcibly sterilized in the 20th century, many of them based on a 1927 U.S. Supreme Court ruling, Buck v. Bell. Carrie Buck was a poor white girl who was sent to the Virginia colony for epileptics and feeble-minded after she was raped and became pregnant. She was misdiagnosed as feeble-minded using the diagnostic language of the day, and she became a test case for state enforced sterilization for those considered mentally defective and unfit to reproduce. This was based on eugenics, a popular idea about 100 years ago, now discredited, about genetic traits, heredity, and improving the purity of the population. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote the 8-1 opinion saying that three generations of imbeciles are enough, referring to Carrie, her mother, and her daughter. Adam Cohen joins us to talk about this shocking period of American history that influenced Hitler and his ideas of racial superiority. Adam Cohen's new book is called Imbeciles, The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marty.
I can hardly say the word imbecile, the title of your book. And I'm assuming in certain ways you want us to say that word because how shocking it is.
Absolutely. They used the word imbeciles a lot back then, also idiot and moron.
And this was based on the sort of diagnostic psychological tools of the day to categorize people based on the whether they were an idiot, whether they were an imbecile, or whether they were a moron.
These were official categories. They were actually in government pamphlets. Yes, idiots at the bottom, imbeciles in the middle, morons at the top.
Tell us about Carrie Buck.
Yeah, her story is so very sad. She grew up poor with a single mother in Charlottesville, Virginia, was living on the street part of the time, was taken in by a foster family with the thought that they would try to make her life better, but they didn't. They treated her very badly. They made her do housework for them and for the neighbors. And then one summer, she was actually raped by the wife's nephew, and they suddenly had this foster child who was pregnant out of wedlock. And what did they decide to do? Not to help her with the pregnancy, but to get her declared epileptic and feeble-minded and sent off to this Dickensian institution called the Virginia Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded.
Well, you even write in this book, you feel as if the family was covering up for a crime. I mean, if she had been raped, clearly that was a crime. But the idea was instead of dealing with it, what had happened to her, they sent her off.
Exactly. It was scandalous to be pregnant at that time. They were probably protecting the nephew. And it unfortunately, it was just too easy back then to get someone like Carrie declared feeble-minded and shipped away for who knows how long.
Now, how did she end up in this house? Her mother seemed to have some problems. I mean, spent some of the time on the street. There were some questions, I guess, about what her life was about.
That's right. And it's interesting because it was a progressive thought in that era. There was a movement called the Child Savers. They thought that taking poor children away from their mothers and fathers and putting them in middle-class families would help them. But Carrie Buck's is certainly an example of where that does not work.
Tell us about this colony, the Virginia Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded.
Yeah, back then the idea was if you get epileptics, who were also regarded as a group that had to be removed from society back then, and feeble-minded, and I use that word advisedly,
sure,
people out in the country with the fresh air, they could do work on farms and things like that, that it would somehow help them to be cured. But in fact, none of these people were ever cured, so it was not really.
I mean, was it an asylum? Were people abused there? Were they misused there?
You know, I actually think that they weren't, you know, they weren't tortured, they weren't treated terribly, but they weren't cured, and they were often, as with Carrie Buck, there was nothing wrong with them. So to be locked away, they were really not patients. They were inmates, not able to leave. In some cases, Carrie Buck's mother, she was there her entire life. I mean, that is certainly a form of cruelty.
Now, Carrie did have a baby, Vivian. What happened to Vivian?
Yeah, so she gives birth and she's not allowed to take her baby with her to the colony. The same foster family that had mistreated her so much took her baby and raised it as their own, although sadly Vivian died at the age of 8 of a childhood disease. But we do know from her school records that there was nothing wrong with her mentally.
What do we know about Carrie Buck's school records? And she did spend some of her childhood going to school.
Absolutely. And it's another very sad part of the case. Carrie was actually doing fine in school. We have her grades. There was nothing mentally wrong with her. But the family took her out after fifth grade and had her do more housework. So therefore, she was actually undereducated, not underintelligent.
So how did she get diagnosed as feeble-minded, again, using the language of that day?
Yeah. So when she got pregnant, it was not that hard for the foster family to bring her before what they called a commission of feeble-mindedness with a judge and two doctors. They did very little review view of evidence. They didn't look at her school records. They didn't talk to her teachers, people who had vouched for her intelligence. They just decided she was epileptic and feeble-minded and sent her off. And the epileptic part is remarkable because she had never had a seizure and in her entire life never had a seizure. She wasn't epileptic. Didn't stop them, though.
This is based in part on this eugenics movement that got, what, started at the turn of the last century?
Yeah, in actually mid to late 1800s in England, the followers of Charles Darwin, and in particular Charles Darwin's half-cousin, a man named Francis Galton, decide what nature is doing, as Darwin described, you know, survival of the fittest, man could do themselves. If we just decide who should reproduce and who shouldn't, we'll get the fittest possible race. So that's how they came up with this so-called science of eugenics.
Well, as you say, this was a very popular idea taught in medical schools, in popular magazines.
So popular. And, you know, the leaders of our society back then were in favor of it. So the president of Harvard, President Lowell, the emeritus professor, president of Harvard, President Eliot, the president of Stanford, Alexander Graham Bell, Theodore Roosevelt, and yes, popular magazine, popular books. There was a popular movie. This was part of our culture. Mm.
This also was a time when there was a pretty large wave of immigrants coming from Eastern Europe, Southern Europe as well. How did that factor into this idea of eugenics?
Yeah, so a lot of historians would say that this was an anxious time. We think of the 20s as being flappers and, you know, prohibition and parties and all that. But actually, a lot of Americans were worried. They saw the highest levels of immigration. They saw religious difference. They saw national difference. And a lot of them were scared. And one theory is that eugenics was a way to try to take control of a changing country. So we see the upper classes and the middle classes, the sort of fancy people, really drawn to it.
Mm. Because what, they wanted to keep the country Anglo-Saxon? I'm trying to think of 100 years ago.
Absolutely. Anglo-Saxon, native, and also just in a time when everything was changing and they felt degrading. They thought these new immigrants were lowering the country, bringing us down. They wanted to try to lift us up through science. Kind of crazy now.
Well, Harry, is it Laughlin?
Yes.
He was one of the really leading proponents of this idea of eugenics. Who was he and what did What did he believe?
Yeah, he's a big villain of my book. He was born
in – There are
a
number of villains in your book.
A lot of bad people here. So he was born in Missouri. He actually came east to run something called the Eugenics Record Office on Long Island in New York. And that was the leading research and advocacy group for eugenics. So Laughlin became the national leading expert on eugenics. He drew up the model statute for sterilizing people that other states used when they drew up their own laws. And he was the expert witness in Carrie Buck's case who said that she was – feeble-minded, which of course she was not, and said that she should be sterilized, which of course she shouldn't have been.
You include the model law in eugenical sterilization in the United States. This is Laughlin, called for sterilizing the feeble-minded, insane, criminalistic, epileptic, inebriate, diseased, blind, vision impaired, deaf. I'm just looking through here. Deformed and dependent. I mean, those were people who could potentially be sterilized.
Absolutely. And the last one you mentioned, dependent, of course, just means poor, right? So they really thought that if you were poor, that that was some genetic flaw and that you weren't worthy of passing on your genes. Very scary stuff.
And that's what the idea, which was if you prevent these people from having babies, you can prevent them from passing on their genes.
Right. So in a few generations, we would get, you know, we would get a sort of master race, if you will, of people who were born to rich people and to people who weren't deaf and weren't blind. This was sort of, you know, I hate to say it, but this was Nazism before the Nazis.
And interesting, Harry Laughlin was epileptic or had epilepsy. So he would have been included in his list that he made.
Absolutely. And towards the end of his life, he began to have a number of seizures, was actually not allowed to drive, and it never changed his view about this. So it does raise that question that comes up so often, how much of hatred begins with self-hatred? Was he condemning himself? And he and his wife never have had children, and we don't really know if that's because he really felt he was an unworthy life himself.
Well, Margaret Sanger also was a believer in this eugenics.
She was, and partly for strategic reasons. She made an alliance with the movement for birth control, but she definitely said some things that read quite ugly to today's ear.
In what way?
Well, she spoke about other nationalities and how they were, you know, were a threat, that type of thing. But there's a huge debate over her legacy, and her defenders say she never really meant it, or that maybe the newspaper articles were misquoting it. But there does seem to be a problem there.
I mean, Darwinism or social Darwinism seems to come out of progressive ideas, liberal ideas.
Absolutely true. And if you think about it, you know, what do progressives believe? They believe that we should keep moving forward. We should take advantage of progress, particularly scientific progress, to make a better world. And this really was an idealistic movement. Make a better world, make a better race. But this is progressivism really gone down the absolute wrong track.
You describe, and this is kind of gruesome, but, you know, ways of controlling reproduction. You've got castration. You've got marriage prohibition. You've got segregation, which is basically institutionalizing people. And then you also have sterilization.
Correct. And when the eugenicists started out, there really were very primitive methods of doing this. Castration was a big one. And they found it hard to sell state legislatures on it because it sounded barbaric. So one, you know, tragedy of all this is that as the medicine got better, eugenic sterilization just sort of, you know, cut the tubes, things like that seemed kind of like a mild intervention. It was not mild. And Carrie Buck, you know, really was under the knife and was bedridden for a couple weeks. But it looked like it was something that was somehow acceptable to do.
And I do want to talk about how she became this test case for the U.S. Supreme Court. So she's at this colony or this colony in Virginia. And why does she get, I guess, picked to be this test case?
Yeah. So in a life of really bad luck, her bad luck continued when she arrived there just after Virginia had passed a eugenic sterilization law. And under the advice of their lawyers, the state hospitals wanted to test it in the courts before they began sterilizing people. So she got there just when they were looking to create a test case. And the superintendent of the colony, a man named Dr. Albert Priddy, was drawn to her immediately. And for a number of reasons. One is that she had already given birth. You know, she got pregnant at the age of 17. So to them, that looks like an example of what they were afraid of, which is that the feeble-minded were reproducing at a rapid rate and were going to take over the country. Of course, she'd been raped, so that was not, you know, correct at all. But so she had given birth already. She had a mother who was already at the colony labeled feeble-minded, so they could show – they wanted to show three generations. And, you know, so she looked perfect to them for their case.
We're almost up in a break here. As you describe Albert Priddy, he was focused on oversexed, immoral, and man-crazy women.
Yeah. You know, that was a big thing at the time. This word feeble-minded could be stretched very broadly. And one category they brought in with it was women who they thought were too interested in sex. And there were people that were signed up to be sterilized just for that reason. And they would call them feeble-minded, but they weren't mentally defective in any way. They just were, you know, not keeping, you know, touch with the morals of the time.
I mean, just being just too randy, to use the language of the day.
Yeah, but you would, of course, be shocked by what counted as too randy then. You know, this would be a girl who hung out with boys in her class, you know, or went on hiking trips. You know, I mean, it was not, you know, nothing too far out there. But these were, you know, not good times and, of course, really not good times for women.
Let me just reintroduce you. That's Adam Cohen, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called Imbeciles, and it's subtitled The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. We're going to take a very short break and continue our conversation. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Adam Cohen about his new book, Imbeciles, The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck, based on a Supreme Court decision going back to 1927, Buck v. Bell, when the Supreme Court upheld the state of Virginia's right to forcibly sterilize a young woman named Carrie Buck. And Oliver Wendell Holmes, writing for the court, talked about, and this was an 8-1 decision, I should say, said famously or infamously, three generations of imbeciles are enough. 1-888-477-9499. So she's at this, Carrie Buck is at this colony run by a guy who's clearly wants to test Virginia's law. And for whatever reason, I guess the fact that she's the daughter and the mother of a child that have been, what, declared feeble-minded? That's why she becomes this test case?
Yeah, they decide they can get the baby declared feeble-minded, which they do in the most bogus possible way. It's an infant, but they are able to send an expert to say that it seems to be reacting slowly. There's nothing wrong with the baby. But yeah, this allowed them to say three generations, although it wasn't true.
So who was her lawyer? Who represented her?
So they gave her a lawyer, but the lawyer was actually one of their friends, someone who'd been the board of directors chair of the colony. And he seemed pretty clearly not to be trying to help her win. He wrote really
Irving
short.
Irving Whitehead, right?
Irving Whitehead, absolutely. And this man named Irving Whitehead, who wrote bad briefs, short briefs, briefs that sometimes made arguments that seemed to be on the other side. So she really didn't have any friends in this process.
In fact, he had been the chairman of the board at the colony.
Yes, and was friends with the director who was trying to get her sterilized. So he was, you know, he was a plant. He was someone that they gave her to really look out for their interests, not hers.
Well, you're a lawyer. If she had had a good lawyer, how would her case perhaps in today's world, but how could or should her case have been represented?
Yeah, I mean, much more could have been done. You know, she had no expert witnesses at trial, whereas the other side had expert witnesses that were very compelling. And they didn't put in her school records. I mean, they should have put in her grades and showed these are not the grades of a feeble-minded person. She was doing perfectly well in fifth grade. They could have brought in her teachers and her fellow students. And later in life, everyone who knew her said she wasn't feeble-minded. She was quite intelligent. It's not to say she would have won because the Supreme Court was so wrapped up in eugenics, but there was a fight to be made here, and it was not made.
And she herself was not asked to testify. And one wonders, you know, if she had been, whether the fact that she was educated and it seemed to certainly later in life she would do crossword puzzles and read and that whether she could have represented herself better than her lawyer.
Absolutely right. And also the Virginia law had a particular provision, the only one in the country that did, saying that the sterilization had to be in the interest of the patient. And they sort of argued that it was. But it would be nice to hear from her saying, mm-hmm. I do not want to be sterilized. This is not in my interest. I want to have children. That would have been very compelling.
In the interest of the patient to protect them, what, from themselves?
Yeah. And the argument that they made was kind of a screwy one. They said, well, you know, if they are sterilized, they can then be released from the colony and let go, and they can lead a nice life outside the colony. So they said that's really more important. But someone like Carrie might have said, no, I don't want to be sterilized. I'll stay here until I can vindicate my rights. But she wasn't – we never hear her voice in this.
So how did this get to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yeah. So they're working their way up the courts. They want as high a ruling as they can get. So the Virginia Supreme Court upholds the trial court's order ruling that she should be sterilized, gets taken up to the Supreme Court, and there it is. It's a live controversy, and the court, I'm sure, was excited to get it because there were some eugenicists on that court. They were pretty interested in the issue.
Including Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who you described as a eugenicist, and he wrote the 8-1 decision.
That's correct. And, you know, he's one of the most famous justices in American history, really revered, almost a demigod in law schools. His father was Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., the dean of Harvard Medical School, and he was a big Boston Brahmin, so from these old Boston families. And it was actually the father, Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., who coined that phrase, Boston Brahmin. They had this idea about themselves that they were a higher American caste, just like the Brahmins in India, that they were better. And that was something Oliver Wendell Holmes grew up thinking. So when eugenics came along, it was very natural for him to say, yeah, I do believe I'm better than someone like Harry Buck.
I mean, did he say things as overtly as that, or was it more sort of embedded in opinions that he might have written?
Well, he actually wrote some law review articles where he talked about eugenics, and he also had a very cynical view of life and the law. He just thought that that everything was a battle, it was the jungle, and that the strong survived and the strong should survive. So it was very social Darwinistic.
I was going to say, that sounds like social Darwinism.
Social Darwinism, but it also sounds kind of like the fancy Boston Brahmins who thought, we're at the top of the heap in Boston, we have all the good jobs, we have all the money, we run the textile mills, and that's as it should be because we're the better, more powerful, more worthy people. So he really believed this stuff.
You want to take him off his pedestal after writing or researching this book?
Absolutely. I mean, he's revered as, you know, one of the wisest men, one of the fairest men, one of the most progressive men to serve on the court. It's just not true. And it's sort of tragic, I think, the way in which this case doesn't get talked about. So when people talk about what a great justice he is, this is really not part of his legacy.
Well, and he famously says three generations of imbeciles are enough, talking about Carrie Buck, her, I guess, her daughter and her mother. But back up, there was only five paragraphs. paragraphs. But back up, what did the court rule? And this was an 8-1 decision.
Yeah, so it rejected all the claims that Carrie's, you know, so-so lawyer made on her behalf, said that there were no constitutional problems, no equal protection, no due process problems, no that she fell squarely within the Virginia statute. The statute was constitutional. But one of the very shocking things about the opinion is that the court goes on to actually say, we need more eugenics. It said that America is being, you know, swamped by a tide of incompetence and that we need more sterilizations. So that's something it's very shocking for the court to do, not just ruling on the case before it, on the law before it, but giving eugenic advice to the country.
And who was the one that voted against it, and do we know why he did?
So interestingly, it was the one Catholic on the court, quite conservative, and we think it was probably because many Catholics at the time opposed eugenics. They are actually the hero of my book. So when laws were introduced, state bills for eugenic sterilization, the one group that consistently showed up to oppose them wasn't the progressives, wasn't the League of Women Voters, which actually argued for the laws. It was the Catholics. Nuns and priests and lay people would go there. And I think it's for two reasons. One is the Catholic Church's traditional respect for procreation. But the other thing is that Catholics viewed people as they thought people should be evaluated based on their souls, who they were inside, not on these external physical characteristics that the eugenicists were so focused on. So because of that, it was the Catholics who really turned out. And there were states like Louisiana, big Catholic population, where a eugenics bill was voted down really because the Catholics opposed it.
Well, let me read about I'm flipping through your book here. There is a governor of Pennsylvania, Governor Samuel Penny Packer.
Yes.
And he fights back against the eugenicists.
Yeah. I mean, as we've said, there are so few heroes in this book, so few people who looked out for Carrie or looked out for the people who were being sterilized or did anything good. Governor Penny Packer of Pennsylvania was one. And in 1905, when Pennsylvania's legislature, like many, introduces a eugenic sterilization law and they pass it, Governor Samuel Penny Packer refused to sign it. And he gave a very stern rebuke when he said no. He said, it's plain that the safest and most effective method of preventing procreation would be to cut off the heads of the inmates. And he said that the bill would allow that, but you know, obviously this is outrageous. And he also really chastised people for following science too much and not thinking about the effects of science. He got it completely right.
Were there other governors like him, from what you could tell?
Yeah, no, very few. I mean, there were a few. There were a couple other bills that were vetoed, and you know, that becomes a drama in some states. But by and large, there was support in the legislature, among governors, and usually by the courts, although not always.
Penny Packer, you describe as a progressive reformer, perhaps a different kind of progressive reformer, and an opponent of child labor.
Exactly.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Adam Cohen, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's titled Imbeciles, The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck, talking about a 1927 Supreme Court ruling that did uphold the state of Virginia's right to forcibly sterilize this young woman, Carrie Buck, talking about what the court decided, its impact, not just on Carrie Buck herself, but on states as well, and raising some questions about its influence on Adolf Hitler and what he did in Nazi Germany. 1-888-477-9499, the number to call to join the conversation. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Did Carrie Buck know when she was sterilized that that was the surgery or the procedure she was having?
You know, it seems probable that she did, but because it was the center of a lawsuit and all that, although we don't know much about her thinking. What we do know is that her sister Doris, who was sterilized right after her, did not know. And as an adult, as an old woman, was told what happened to her. And when she was told, she and her husband began weeping because they'd been trying for decades to have a child and they didn't know she'd been sterilized. Doris Buck had been told that she had some kind of an appendectomy or something. So, you know, a lot of women had that experience of not even knowing what was done to them.
So we know a little bit about what happened to Carrie Buck. Obviously, she's released from the colony, what, after she's sterilized?
Yes. When she's no longer a threat, they let her go. And yet another tragedy of her story is all the way through they were saying to her, you know, if you get sterilized, one great thing is that the foster family will take you back and you can then live with your daughter, the only child you'll ever have. So this was said repeatedly. It was said in the court papers. But when she was actually ready to be let go, that family didn't want her. So they kept her child and wouldn't let her rejoin her child. So she ends up working for various families around Virginia as doing household work. But she does marry two times. She seems to get on with her life. But this was always a very sad part of it. And when she was interviewed as an old woman, she said that, you know, she'd always wanted to have babies and have a family. And, you know,
so tragic. I mean, it's just heartbreaking when you think about it. And as you said, she and her husband wanted to have children and didn't perhaps know why they couldn't have children.
Yeah, it's a sad, sad story. And to think that this was not some, you know, some mere chance or just some crazy doctor in a lab somewhere. This was the United States Supreme Court 8-1 who condemned her to this life for no good reason.
And what, 70,000 women sterilized in the 20th century based on this Supreme Court ruling?
Yeah, I mean, some before and then after. Yeah, but we think that during the sterilization era, 70,000 people, you know, men and women were sterilized, and many more were locked away for their reproductive years. That was another thing they did. So there were a lot of victims here, absolutely. So real, you know, real painful time in our nation's history.
Locked away in institutions or prisons or jails or just locked away?
All of the above. And, you know, many in colonies like the Virginia Colony for Epileptic and Feeble-Minded, people like Carrie's mother who was locked up for her entire life, right? Never allowed to go out because she was deemed feeble-minded. So she was a prisoner for life, never committed a crime, you know.
So. Do we know when the last person sterilized under this Supreme Court ruling, who that was and when that was?
Well, you know, unbelievably, under the eugenic sterilization regime, the last sterilization occurred in Oregon in 1981. So that's really recent. But, you know, there still are eugenic sterilizations that are going on subterraneously. We hear reports about them occurring in prisons in California. There was a prosecutor in Tennessee who was fired a couple years, allegedly for making sterilization part of his plea negotiations. Yeah. It's sort of out there, but we don't necessarily hear about it.
A comment from Jose: why hasn't the Supreme Court revisited this case and changed the judgment? Seems like they should correct themselves. Are they scared of admitting that a mistake had been made? I mean, where does this ruling stand then?
Great question. But you know, in 1942, they had an opportunity to reconsider it when they were considering an Oklahoma law. They actually struck down the Oklahoma law on narrow grounds, but specifically upheld Buck versus Bell. And as recently as 2001, a U.S. Court of Appeals in Missouri—that's just one step below the U.S. Supreme Court in the federal system, cited Buck versus Bell in a case involving sterilization of a mildly mentally retarded woman. It's the law.
It is still the law.
Yeah, it's the law. They haven't changed it.
So you need someone to challenge that law? I mean, someone to take a case like this up to the Supreme Court?
You would, but you'd also need the court to say that, you know, if you had a system like they had in Buck versus Bell where people had due process rights, where they had a lawyer, where everything was taken care of in that regard, and that if there was something wrong with them, that the state shouldn't be able to sterilize them. We don't know that that's the current thinking on the court.
Talk about the Immigration Act then of 1924. This comes around the same time as this Supreme Court ruling.
Yeah. So the eugenicists had two methods of trying to uplift the national gene pool. One was to try to get the people who are already here to have the right ones reproduce and the, quote, wrong ones not reproduce. The other was to keep out people that they thought were going to diminish the gene pool in the United States. So that was immigration. There was thought at the time that certain nationalities, Italians, Eastern European Jews, Asians, were inferior, that their genes were not as good. And the 1924 Immigration Act passed by Congress was incredibly passed in significant part for eugenic reasons. Harry Laughlin, who we've spoken about already, was actually appointed expert eugenics agent by the U.S. Congress. I've seen the letterhead. He testified about the eugenic deficiencies of some nationalities. So the 1924 Act put huge quotas, you know, very low quotas on countries that we thought were deficient and tried to get more people to come from England and places that we thought were of superior stock. So, yeah.
I mean, you mentioned Jews in particular, and I'm thinking about the impending war. Anne Frank's father applies, for a visa to come to America.
Yeah, so many of the people who were shut out by this, you know, law were Jews who were trying to flee Nazi Germany, and many of them were trying to get here, but suddenly there were these quotas in place, whereas before the 1924 Act and a couple years earlier there was a different act. Before that, it was possible to just show up at Ellis Island and generally get into the country. So yeah, Jews who were trying to flee the Nazis were big victims, and as you say, correspondence came to light a few years ago in which Otto Frank was writing repeatedly to the State Department begging for a visa for himself, his wife, and his two daughters, Margot and Anne, and he was turned down really because of the Immigration Act of 1924. So That's why Anne Frank couldn't come to America. So when we learn in school that Anne Frank died in a concentration camp because the Nazis thought the Jews were genetically deficient, that's true. But to some extent, Anne Frank died in a concentration camp because the U.S. Congress believed that as well.
Which, of course, you know, gives it a whole different narrative.
Yes, yes.
I'm curious, too, about just how much – I mean, Hitler apparently praised the Immigration Act of 1924 and how much eugenics or even the American version or style of eugenics, how much that influenced Hitler himself.
Yeah, well, it's chilling to see that Harry Laughlin, this, you know, villain of the book, is in correspondence with the Nazi scientists. He's printing some of their work in his eugenics journal, which he publishes here in the United States. He says with pride that he sees that the Nazis are following our model with their eugenic statute. And when in the Nuremberg trials after World War II, when we put the Nazis on trial for eugenic sterilization, they defended themselves by pointing to Buck versus Bell. And in the classic movie Judgment at Nuremberg,
yes,
there's a scene where Maximilian Schell, who plays the Nazi lawyer, actually reads from Buck versus Bell. And they felt, how can we condemn them for eugenic sterilization when we were the ones who invented it?
And what was the American response to that? Do we
know? Yeah. In the movie, it's really sort of a scene ender, because what can you say? It shows that, you know, I mean, we were more the precursors of some parts of Nazism than certainly we would like to remember.
And one, I'm just thinking a bit more about Anne Frank. I mean, one wonders, you know, if she and her family had been allowed into the United States, she would have lived.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, she's one that we know and we think of her as an individual because of her amazing diary. But there were so many other, obviously, equally worthy young girls and young boys and older folks who were trying to get here who could have lived also. It's just a tragedy of large proportions.
Well, let's take another break and then we'll get back to our conversation. I see a lot of people want to join it as well. We've got some email comments at radiotimes@whyy.org, some comments from our Facebook page, and you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And again, call us at 1-888-477-9499. We are frankly talking about a troubling and very shameful period in our history. And our guest is Adam Cohen, author of a new book called Imbeciles, The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Adam Cohen about Imbeciles, also about, that's the title of his book, and also about eugenics. This was the pseudoscientific idea of improving the human race through breeding, through genetics, enormously popular back about 100 years ago in this country, in politics, in academics, medicine, and the law, even the highest court in the land. In 1927, in a case Buck v. Bell, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the state of Virginia's right to forcibly sterilize a young woman named Carrie Buck. She was diagnosed erroneously as feeble-minded or an imbecile, guided by pseudoscience. Oliver Wendell Holmes famously wrote in the 8-1 decision, "Three generations of imbeciles are enough." This ruling paved the way for states across the country to sterilize, considered to be something like 70,000 people, many without consent or knowledge. That's what our guest Adam Cohen writes about in his new book. Let me read a couple of comments here. An email from Peter. He says, local author Judith Newman, in their book Against Their Will, that's the name of the book, Against Their Will, describes experiments on children at Pennhurst and other institutions. Doctors felt based on continued vitality of eugenics in the 1950s. And as you said, I mean, it didn't really come to an end until maybe 1981 in a state in the West. But in the 1950s, I guess, this wasn't that unusual.
Absolutely. And in the 1970s, and in some states, there are people getting reparations or their movements for reparations. So there are a lot of people alive today who were sterilized for eugenic reasons. It's a tragedy.
I mean, have states or institutions or individuals repudiated some of the thinking behind eugenics?
Yeah, absolutely. And that, now it's really very much discredited. But as I say, I think it's still going on, you know, subterraneously in various prisons or parts of the justice system. I don't think we know the extent of it.
And it's interesting to think of Darwin or social Darwinism. I think, you know, people that probably think that they're forward thinking and, you know, understand about evolution and things like that, to think about eugenics in terms of that does raise some, I think, troubling questions.
Yeah. And, you know, yes. And, Dr. Albert Priddy is the villain of my book. He's the head of the Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded. But I think if we try to get in his head, he thought, well, feeble-mindedness is very bad. We don't have a cure for it. If we could just breed it out, that would sort of save future generations. So it's terrible. But I think some of them had some, you know, well-meaning aspect to what they were thinking.
Let me read an email from Susan. Please ask Mr. Cohen to name a Supreme Court justice who voted against sterilization. He deserves to be acknowledged. Oh, we mentioned the one, but
yes.
I don't think we named him.
Oh, well, let's name him. Pierce Butler. He was the only Catholic on the court, one of the most conservatives. One reason he's not better known, even in this case, is that he didn't write a dissenting opinion. Mm-hmm. So there's been that silence, and we can kind of guess what he was thinking, but there wasn't a gripping account of what was wrong from him. But he definitely is one of the heroes of the story.
As you said, this could be happening subterraneanly or, you know, without our knowledge. But do you think the idea of eugenics has been discredited, or do you think it's people still believe this stuff maybe in their heart of hearts?
Well, you know, one source of all information these days is the comment sections of internet websites, which I spend a lot of time on with the subject of eugenics because of writing this book. There's a lot of talk there about eugenics, pro eugenics. So, and I think, you know, when you get people alone in their, you know, in their basement writing on the internet, they will say that some people shouldn't reproduce, you know, and it's usually whatever political party they don't agree with or whatever. But I think that it still resonates with people. I absolutely do.
And why is it wrong? You, in the beginning of the book, you describe some of the scientific reasons why eugenics really doesn't make sense.
Yeah. There's so many reasons it's wrong. One is that the science is not right. It's pseudoscience. Another reason is that that I don't subscribe to a view where only the most fit, whatever that is, should be able to reproduce. You know, so what if you don't meet their criteria? So what if you are blind? I think blind people should be able to have children. I think that disabled people should be able. So that whole idea that only certain people should have this right to have children is right. Offensive. And then also, of course, even if there were some value to it, you can never trust the government to get it right, as in the case of Carrie Buck. There was nothing wrong with her. So it's not a good idea.
Let me get Mike from Lansdowne to join our conversation. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Has Virginia or even any other state tried to repeal any of these laws and in the past, or any movement since the book came out?
Sure. Thanks, Mike.
Sure. Yeah. No, the laws are pretty much gone now. So, yes, they have. Virginia repealed its law in the 70s, and they're talking about reparations right now. We've moved beyond that. I think in many cases what's troubling about the Supreme Court case still being valid is who knows what's going to happen in the next few years. I think even in the last hour of your show, we heard about just how crazy things are in American politics right now. What if some state or even Congress begins to get some bad ideas? We'd like to believe the Supreme Court would stand up against it, but right now, they're not against it.
I mean, we are a nation of immigrants, as we all know, but we're also a country that has fought immigration and fought against certain kind of immigrants.
That's right. So, you know, a lot of this book is about fear of the other, fear of those who are different, fear of being polluted by people who aren't like us. That was the eugenic idea. And yeah, you see that in our rhetoric today in politics. So it really does speak today. We're not talking about eugenics, but it's in the immigration debate. Absolutely.
An email from Johnny says, I'm a patriotic American. I recognize freedom is essential, but there are too many people. The forced sterilization is clearly a bad idea, but in our culture, the idea of not having kids, not having a family is just about a taboo. The only thing I would do is to make not having kids a more respectable idea. I mean, we do have birth control. I mean, we have many more things today than women had back in 1927.
No, and he raises a great point. We are getting too many people for this planet. But I think, as you say, the answer is birth control, maybe more education about zero population growth, all those things. What we don't want, though, is the government saying, you're a good person, you can have children, you're a bad person, you can't.
Do you think this is also, and this goes back to the head of the colony, how he felt about women, about controlling women's bodies, women's reproduction, women's biology?
Absolutely. It's very much in that tradition. And knowing better for the woman, you know, what she should do. And, you know, the fact that the Virginia law had this provision, it had to be in the patient's interest. And they never asked Carrie Buck what she wanted. They decided that this was in her interest. You know, that's exactly what you're saying.
Comment from Amy. Have you looked into the forced sterilization of Native American women in government hospitals in the 1970s? Most of them didn't know this was happening to them.
I have not, but I'm sure that that requires more investigation. There were also Latino women in Southern California. I think that there's a lot of hidden history here that we need historians and regular citizens to go after, because there's a story that's not being told.
An email from Kira. She says, my daughter has epilepsy, and this conversation is important to our family. I'd be interested to know how this law was applied to people with epilepsy and on what justification. Also, my understanding is that this law is still on the books. Do you have any concern that this activity might be revived in the current political climate? You touched on that earlier, but she was asking specifically about people with epilepsy.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating part of the story that epileptics were considered by many of these state laws to be unworthy of reproducing. And one of the real ironies of all this is that Harry Laughlin, the villain of my book, who said that epileptics should be prohibited from reproducing and wrote that into his Miles statute, he was an epileptic.
Right.
So the fact that he had this sort of self-hate going on. I don't think that there are laws right now that have this, but, you know, it does point to the fact that epileptics have been misunderstood gravely throughout American history.
An email from David. He says, I worked with welfare rights in North Carolina in the late 60s, and sterilization was strongly pushed onto welfare clients there.
Yes, and that's a state where people are actually getting reparations. It was, there were different states where it occurred at different times. Virginia was pretty enthusiastic very late in the game and to tragic results.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. A lot of comments there that I just read. We'll make room for some more. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And again, Adam Cohen is our guest. We're talking about his new book, Imbeciles, the Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. We've got Jane from Vermont calling us on Radio Times. And Jane, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Okay. I've lost reception, so I'm not sure where you are in the discussion, but at one point you were talking about why she might not have perhaps fought harder to defend herself and to not have to go through with the sterilization. Mm-hmm. And just given what you were saying, you know, that she was raped and her child was taken away from her, to me, a statement of how that trauma had really affected her, perhaps. I mean, it's not inconceivable to think that maybe she had just was given up.
Well, I mean, she wasn't, as I understand it, Adam, at her trial. I mean, it would be up to her lawyer to determine whether she would testify or not. So do we know if she wanted to and she was denied the right to do that?
We don't know that, but there's this very poignant moment at her sterilization hearing, which occurred in the colony, and that was where they got the order to sterilize her, where we do hear her voice, the only real time we do. And she's asked whether she wants to say anything, and she says that she trusts her people, which is so poignant because she didn't realize that her people were not on her side. And I think the caller is exactly right about, you know, the obstacles that she faced. But I would add one more, that she was taken out of school after fifth grade, right? So she was not even given the tools of education to fight for herself. It's just a terrible story all around.
And the surgical procedure, sort of just what, cutting the fallopian tubes?
Yeah. And, you know, it was 1920s, though, so they weren't that good at it. None of the current microsurgery. So the recuperation actually sounded pretty terrible. She was in bed for a couple weeks, and, you know, you're lucky that nothing went wrong. It's a major invasive surgery.
And what do we know about the Virginia Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded? Does it still exist? Is the building still there?
The building's still there. In the 70s, you know, it became, you know, it shifted and became more progressive. And actually, the guy who was the director in the 70s felt very bad about everything that had happened, and he wanted to sort of, you know, clear the name of the institution. He's the one who tracked down Carrie and Doris and was the one who told them what happened. So, yeah, the folks in Virginia, you know, don't believe this now. When I was doing the research in the state library, you know, they feel as bad about it as we do. You know, it's a dark part of their history.
And why do we know? I mean, some people know Buck v. Bell, but we don't know it the way we know other Supreme Court decisions. Why is that, do you think?
You know, I think it's a real flaw in our sort of legal education. I think we should be talking about it more. I didn't learn it when I was a law student at Harvard. It was not in my constitutional law class. The most famous constitutional law treatise, 1,700 pages about American constitutional law, has a half a sentence and a footnote about this. For some reason, people are not talking about it. Academics are not talking about it. One reason I wrote the book was to try to stimulate a discussion.
But why aren't we talking about it? I mean, when you learn about it, it's so shocking and so revealing of that time period.
I think, you know, part of it is that people wrongly feel, okay, this was an exceptional moment in American history. We got crazy about eugenics and the whole country got crazy about it. The Supreme Court even got crazy about it. But that was a blip and we're not in that era anymore. But I think that's totally wrong. I think that there's still that impetus, you know, in the public today. I also think with the advances in medical science going on right now, the ability to edit the human embryo, which has just happened in China, the potential to do eugenics is going to be greater than ever. We really need to think this stuff through.
And is that why you wrote the book? I mean, how did you, stumble upon this story? You went to Harvard Law School?
Yeah.
Got a good education?
I did, and we didn't learn this case. But we did know this saying, three generations of imbeciles are enough. And I wondered why Oliver Wendell Holmes, whose portrait seemed to be on every wall in the law school, who was so revered right there in Boston, why he wrote that. And I also thought when I did a book about the Supreme Court, I didn't want to write about all the great things they did. I feel that's been said. I wanted to write about one of the worst things they did and try to figure that out. So I looked at this and, you know, you begin poking around in various things when you're looking for a book idea. This became so rich so quickly. I was like, this is an amazing story.
And to quote Oliver Wendell Holmes, three generations of imbeciles are enough, basically saying we're going to stop this now.
Absolutely. Right. And yeah, there's so much wrong with that. But a small thing that's wrong with that horrible sentence is that Carrie and her mother weren't even decreed to be imbeciles. They were judged to be morons, which as we started our conversation by saying, that was a little higher up the pecking order. So in addition to everything else he did, he degraded her by one rank in that horrible sentence.
Unfortunately, we can't take Kathy's call from King of Prussia just because we're almost out of time here. But she says she has a 2-year-old grandson who she's raising with another grandmother. Both parents have either mental issues or brain injury. They want to have another child, but both are unfit. The laws are protecting her and not the children. I mean, this raises, you know, this question about who can have children, who then ends up raising these children, what is in the best interest of the child. I mean, these are issues, Adam, that have not gone away.
Very complicated. But I would say that here in that case, the issue isn't eugenics. It isn't we're worried about our gene pool. It's what's right for the child and for the mother. More complicated and not easy. But it's not about preserving the national gene pool, which is the really creepy part of eugenics.
So what did you learn about America writing this book?
I learned that the weak are often taken advantage of, something I knew already, but that, you know, people like Carrie who have done nothing wrong are often the ones who really bear terrible burdens in our society. We expect the Supreme Court to stand up for them, but over and over again, they don't. So I hope that this will be a moment of modesty for the legal system. And if we think a little harder, are we oppressing people that we should be protecting?
Because isn't the court supposed to almost do the opposite? I mean, to protect the weak against the strong and powerful.
Exactly. That is the ideal of the law, is that it should protect the weak from the strong. But if you actually look at the Supreme Court's history in everything from Plessy versus Ferguson, where they upheld racial segregation, Dred Scott, where they said a slave couldn't sue for his freedom, all the way up to Citizens United, they have a real penchant for siding with the powerful, not the powerless who they should be protecting.
Are you working on another book?
Yeah, but I think my publisher won't let me say what it is yet. But yeah, it's underway.
Well, Adam Cohen, thank you so much for joining us and telling us this really disturbing but very important story.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Adam Cohen, our guest. And again, the book is called Imbeciles, The Supreme Court, American Eugenics and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. He's a former member of the New York Times editorial board and a senior writer for Time magazine. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.